Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's time to take a look at remodeling on the show. And we're going to talk and zero in a bit on remodeling your kitchen or your bathroom. That could be one of the most significant ways, I think, to increase the value of your home. But it also comes with a cost, and we'll talk about that. And those projects can be complicated and certainly costly. And a couple of folks with us. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Always a pleasure to be here.
And a pleasure to have Diana Langreich with us as well. Diana's lead sales designer at Bella Domicile in Madison. And good to have you back, Dana.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it.
As we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. And these two have a lot of experience. Bella has spent the 14 years, I think, working in sales for Gordon, did work for Gordon Eagle Log and Timber? Yeah. No?
No.
I don't know where that came from. It was part of some information I had in front of me, and it is definitely incorrect.
That's okay. I've been in the industry since the year 2000 and worked for multiple remodeling companies, especially in the area. And Reno, Nevada is actually where I started my career.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. As while we're at it, you might as well tell us about Bella Domicile. I mean, you were with us once, I think, weren't you?
Yeah, I think about 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so refresh our memories on Bella Domicile.
Sure. Family-owned company. We're on the southwest side of Madison. And our specialty is definitely space planning and helping clients through the entire process of remodeling. Mm-hmm. And we do sell products there. And so cabinetry is our main product that we work with. And we do carry multiple lines of cabinetry, different brands, so that we're able to meet a lot of different budgets and then also different design aesthetics. And then we can help our clients with countertops, tile, plumbing fixtures, light fixtures. I would say a lot of people specifically choose to work with us because we can help them through the very planning stage all the way through the end of the project and get them paired up with general contractors to execute the labor on the project.
Yeah. And, Chad, you've been doing this for a long time, but talk about Chad's Design Build, because I sometimes forget to ask about
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah, well, so we've been in business for 34 years, started out as Chad's Carpentry. We've been doing business as Chad's Design Build for about 15 years
yeah.
now. And we are a full-service residential remodeling company. We do start the process with good planning, and mm-hmm. often there's a design element to that. We do have designers on staff. And then, of course, we're going to, once we've developed the project and finalized the scope and cost, if the client then moves forward with the construction,
yeah.
We're going to, of course, do that, deliver that service. And, we have a staff of carpenters and project managers.
So we have a couple of very experienced folks with us today, and as you listen in, I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. We're zeroing in to start on bathrooms and kitchens, but of course we can talk about a broad range of things with our guests. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You know, my daughter rents a home in Kansas, and I asked her not that long ago, she's getting married coming up, and I said, are you interested at all in maybe buying that, seeing if you can buy that house? And she said, no, I wouldn't buy it because the kitchen... Really, there's only it's not set up for more than one person.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of spaces are like that.
Yeah, and she said, "I just can't imagine, getting married. The two of us, we need some more a better design. Is that?" I mean, I'm wondering, is that a common thing that you guys get, or is it, are there other things that make people want to design, you know, redo their kitchen? Start with you, Dana.
Yeah, absolutely. There are ways that you can change it from a one-person space to a multiple-person space. And there are a lot of questions we ask at the beginning of the process to understand who's going to be using it and maybe who's taking care of which tasks. And making sure that there's enough clearance for two bodies to be working in there, creating different work zones. That's definitely a feature that people are looking for when remodeling, is to get more bodies in there at the same time.
And, you know, in my own home, I think I need a stepladder to get to the top of my cabinets. One part of the kitchen.
I just finished my own remodel, and I specifically designed a space for a stepladder. I'm only 5 foot tall, so I have to use a step stool very frequently. And so there is a 5-inch space that fits my stepladder right in there.
Oh, man. Well, what about bathrooms? Why do people, you know, what's going on there? I know when I bought the house that I live in now, the guy was bragging about the remodel he did on the bathroom. He's very proud of it, and I just kept saying, well, it's only going to be here until about 4 days after you bought the house.
Sure. Well, so, you know, bathrooms, they're similar to kitchens, of course. Sometimes the surfaces and the cabinets are just wearing out.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is the aesthetic of the past owner or the builder that the new owner, or maybe someone, you've been living there for 20 years and you've been thinking for many of those years, you know, we're going to change this at some point.
Yeah.
Because we don't like the way it looks. But one of the driving things that's unique to bathrooms, and that we do a lot of, and I'm sure Dana as well, there, you know, as many of us age in place and are living well into our senior years in our homes, bathrooms are rooms that are very hazardous potentially.
Yeah.
Because they're wet surfaces, you can slip. A lot of times you can trip over a standard threshold into a shower, or if you're having to step over the side of a tub to take a shower. And these are opportunities to reimagine those spaces with safer space planning and amenities that just make it easier to utilize the bathroom comfortably and safely. So.
Yeah, Dana?
I would say it's not even just the user being safer for them, but also for the caregivers, that people that might be assisting someone else in the bathroom space. So
sure.
Just how when you've got two bodies maneuvering around, sometimes in a smaller area, how can we help both people stay safe?
And I was thinking, you know, the way, well, with interest rates and for a variety of reasons there, I think people are wanting to stay put. At least that's kind of what nationally is we're seeing, isn't it? And so if you don't want to move because you're at a 3% interest rate, and to buy another one, it'd be 6% probably. That's one reason, yeah. I would think.
Absolutely. I see that frequently. People want to just change what they've got because it doesn't make financial sense to move on.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Talking today with Dana Langreck, lead sales associate for Bella Domicile at the Madison-based home design renovation firm. And, of course, with Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build in Madison. Questions for them, maybe about your bathroom or maybe about your kitchen or maybe you got something else going on. I hope you'll join in. Then the number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. Where do you start on, let's say, a bathroom or a kitchen? I mean, in terms of, you figure, okay, I've got X number of dollars I can spend, or do I start, well, I want to do this?
Sure. Well, that's a great question, Larry. I mean, it's always part of the original conversation. You know, what are the goals? What needs to change or improve, or what amenities do you lack, or what functionality is lacking? And as Dana alluded to earlier, a lot of times it's just having a more functional layout and accommodating more than one person in the space. And then, of course, the question of how much it might cost to do whatever it is you want to do, that's going to have an impact on the solutions that are available to a homeowner. And so that's often how our conversation starts. And if we move into planning, we're going to be guided potentially by the limitation of budget because, you know, we can't create a $250,000 solution when you might have a $50,000 budget.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Absolutely. It is just a lot of questions up front to understand what the primary goals are and trying to make sure that we achieve the most important goals on the list and give information. I think a lot of what Chad and I do are just providing a lot of information to clients so that they can be the decision makers of what they want to invest into their home. And sometimes it's giving them the information so that maybe they'll end up spending a little bit more if they really find that that is the right solution for them. But it's not for us to tell them how much they have to spend. We're just giving the options and ideas.
And I have got to believe there'd be some, you have to take the structure. There could be some structural issues associated with something like this, I would think.
Certainly. And, you know, we talked a few moments ago about sometimes wanting to expand the footprint of the kitchen, say, or the bathroom. Yeah. And it's not unusual that those rooms can be quite cramped in some older homes. And sometimes there's an opportunity to alter the partitions or eliminate a partition in a wall. We've had many kitchen projects and some bathroom projects where a wall has been moved or entirely eliminated to kind of open up the floor plan, particularly with kitchens. Many times people are looking to have a better interaction so that you can be involved in cooking and also socializing potentially with family or house guests. And so, you know, that way you are opening up that room to potentially a living room or dining room. So absolutely, when you are altering the structure of a home, there are many important engineering issues that have to be considered. And you don't want to be, facing unexpected problems in the middle of the project. You want to plan for that, you know, look carefully at the home and figure out, you know, what are the obstacles and opportunities.
Yeah, we had to do, have our lake home that I had at one point, we extended the home out, but it involved a load-bearing wall, and there had to be some structural changes, things done to make sure that that load-bearing wall was still there and bearing a load.
Sure.
There's also the mechanicals, too. So thinking about the HVAC systems and plumbing and electrical that have to be accounted for. And that's why working with a great contractor can help guide you through what can be done with all of those.
Chris in Rice Lake has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I got a question about a bathroom that I'm putting together in a walkout basement. I've got the basement is insulated, and it's got faced insulation on it, paper faced insulation. And I heard that putting drywall over that would not be a good idea. Do you have any idea on that?
Sure. So I believe the issue that you're probably referring to is when you've got a foundation wall, a concrete wall that's mostly below grade, we typically do not want to create a vapor barrier on the inside of that wall. In fact, the code prohibits it because you can trap moisture in that wall. Now, having said that, if you have a paper, like a craft faced insulation, that style of material, that craft face paper, is similar to some newer products on the market which allow moisture to pass through them. It prevents moisture from going into the wall from within the home, but it allows moisture within the wall to be expelled. And so, you know, I don't want to complicate the answer, or perhaps it's too late. But the issue or the important thing here is that we're not trapping moisture in the wall. So there are other ways to approach that, and sometimes it's to have no vapor barrier at all. But the moisture has to be able to escape whatever material is put up.
Yeah, Chris, does that help? Follow up needed or?
Well, I was just wondering what material I should use for, and you know, would drywall be, you know, okay, or is there another wall board that I could use?
So the
because there's plenty of them out there that are you know, very expensive and very inexpensive. I mean, I don't know. I just want to make sure I don't have a mold problem here in a couple of years.
Yeah. So the drywall itself is not the issue, though. Of course, drywall, if it is getting damp and it's not able to dry out, it will be a good medium for mold to develop on the paper face of it. So there are other materials you could use, but it's not typically a problem to have drywall on the interior of a basement. It's just that you want to make sure that the thermal layer does not trap moisture in the wall.
And how do you do that? How do you make sure that it doesn't?
So there's netting that can be put up that is permeable. There are products out there that are sold that are designed for this purpose to allow moisture to escape. And so that's the detail that will prevent that problem. Now, if you're looking for a particular material that is going to be more tolerant of moisture and is not going to be as good of a substrate for mold to take hold, there again, I mean, there are some products out there that you might consider, but you said it was a walkout basement. So where is the, typically with a walkout basement, at least one wall is going to be above grade. And of course, that wall is just like the walls upstairs. It's typically framed and there would be a vapor barrier on it. So is the bathroom going to be tucked back up against the foundation wall?
Yeah, very much.
Okay.
Yeah, the walkout part is all windows, and
okay.
So I'm putting this bathroom in there, and I just I had heard a couple other times on the show that you don't want paper faced insulation up against the concrete wall because you're going to create mold problems, and if I'm putting this bathroom in with drywall with paper faced insulation, it might end up to be a disaster.
Yes. Yeah. So the best thing I would recommend would be to consider using some of the potentially foam board products that you could use for insulation in the wall. Those you're not going to have to worry about if they get wet. They're not going to degrade or settle. Then for the wall material, again, you're going to... there are wall boards that are designed for wet rooms that you could use. There are other materials that you might consider putting up, though typically we're putting up a drywall in those rooms. And then the one important thing that I haven't mentioned is good ventilation is always going to be your friend in a bathroom, because I presume that there's going to be a shower in that bathroom. And so moisture is going to be created, which is going to be the thing that's going to cause the mold threat. So you want to put in a high efficiency bath fan. I always recommend Panasonic, though there are other brands out there, but Panasonic kind of is the quality leader for high efficiency fans. They're quiet and they move air. And then, of course, the ductwork has to be properly installed so that that air, in fact, is able to get out of the house. But if you put in a good, high-quality fan and maybe put that fan on a humidistat or on a timer so that it's going to run longer than when you're in the bathroom, or it's going to run whenever the humidity level reaches a certain point, that is going to help keep that room and the materials within it healthy and dry.
Yeah, no, it makes good sense. Dana?
I was just going to say the same thing. The putting it on a timer or where a sensor is going off or turning the fan on and off, especially if it's in a basement where maybe that's an area that you don't want to stay down there and wait for the to turn the fan back off again, that's really going to be key in that kind of area.
Yeah, and that's probably money well spent. I can't imagine sensors anymore are that expensive. Are they? Or are they?
Way less expensive than redoing your bathroom again because you've got mold.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Chris, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your questions as we talk remodeling and repair with Dana Langreck of Bella Domicile and Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we take a look at home remodeling with our two guests, Dana Langreck and Chad Spade. And join in. Have a question or comment? I hope you will. The number 800-642-1234. You can email us the email address talk@WPR.org. And you know what? We got David from Cleveland, Wisconsin on the line. So let's just go there right now. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So my question is, I'm designing a new kitchen. And typically, people put their kitchen sink in front of the window, but I would like to put my stove in front of the window so I can look outside at Lake Michigan while I am cooking.
Hmm. Dana, go ahead.
I think the view sounds fantastic. Can I come visit? I think that there's definitely just some safety concerns to think about first. And so if you're going to have any window treatments over that window, we need to make sure that there is a clearance from any cooktop to combustible materials. So any wood blinds or curtains, anything like that, could present a safety hazard that you want to combat. Ventilation would also be something to consider. You're not going to want a big hood fan coming down in front of that window and blocking part of that view. And so may need to consider a downdraft ventilation system, or possibly there are some ceiling-mounted fans that will get that motor up and out above the window space. Sometimes what I've done is a deeper countertop area if you're going to be in front of a window. So typical cabinets are just 24 inches deep, but if you went to, say, like a 27 or 30-inch deep cabinet space there with a cooktop in it, then you're going to give a little more separation to that window. And so that's going to help keep your window cleaner and also help with some of those safety things, too.
Wondering, David, what kind of stove are you going to put in?
I think it's going to be gas.
Gas, okay. Because that, I think, will make a difference, wouldn't it?
It sure does.
Sure.
Yeah. There's definitely more considerations for safety with gas than if you were to go induction or electric.
And I would just add that, as Dana said, the ventilation is going to be really crucial. And there are two things that are a part of that ventilation with a gas stove. Of course, with any stove, you want to be concerned about all the humidity that is typically generated by cooking. And when you have a glass window there in front of that stove, we know that, you know, the moist air, when it hits a cold surface, is going to condense. And so you may find that, you know, you don't always have a great view if the air is moving in such a way that you know, condensation is happening with frequency. And then when you have a gas stove, you are going to have a combination of toxic and more benign gas created. You know, you have some carbon monoxide created by the imperfect burning of that fuel, and then carbon dioxide is created just as a natural, well-functioning gas appliance is burning. And I have found in my very tight 20-year-old condo that the carbon dioxide levels can reach what are considered to be an unhealthy level when I'm cooking in my 1,400-square-foot condo that does not have a proper ventilation fan over the cooktop. So, you know, I'm going to be addressing that by putting a proper ventilation fan over the cooktop. But if that fan is not drawing those gases up into it efficiently, then you are going to be dealing with other potential health impacts from that.
Could you use a downdraft system, Dana, in with a gas stove?
You sure can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's different, I'm not an expert in this, but even considering like a remote blower can be incorporated with a downdraft. And so a remote blower means that the motor part of that fan could be on the outside of the home, and that's going to keep your space a little quieter, and then you can get different power levels
with that. And if David said, you know what, maybe I'll try a different type of stove, what would... For being in front of a window, if you were going to put one in for your own home and you had the similar situation, what would you do?
I would say even if it's not in front of a window, I'm a big fan of induction cooking. And so it is it's an electric source, and it is a smooth top surface. So it allows you to easily clean that surface if you were to get splatters and or any bubble overs. But the performance is really like gas. And so a lot of people like using gas for cooking because you can put a burner on very low and leave it on low for a very long time. But you can just hit a couple buttons and then you're already up to a very high temperature very quickly. And you can boil water a lot faster. And so the performance is very much like gas with an induction. And so a lot of cooks really like to use that for those reasons. And it is it's a safer surface. You don't have any open flames. You don't have the heat. There's not like a coil or that's getting hot. And so you can even pick that pan up and use a rag and clean that surface while you're in the middle of cooking. And so even like if there are young children around, it can be a much safer surface to have.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great.
Something
they really are.
Something else for you to think about, David. Does all this help?
Yes, very much so. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@wpr.org. Kitchens and bathrooms both require plumbing, of course. What kind of plumbing deficiencies do you commonly see in when you're looking at a home or, yeah?
So sometimes plumbing is not vented properly, and with a kitchen, the great thing about that is there are newer little gadgets called Sturt vents that allow you to have a mechanical vent under the sink. It doesn't have to be connected to a pipe that goes out of the building, but it allows makeup air to come into that system and keep the drain operating properly. So that's a great little invention that's been around for a few decades that allows for some flexibility.
Is that something you have to ask for, or
it's something that a plumber would, recommend or certainly be able to utilize? Some of the other things that we often see for upgrades in kitchens, it's very handy to be able to have some sort of a faucet over top of a stove so that you can fill a pot right there. That's something that we often add in. Sometimes there's a second sink if the footprint of the kitchen is large enough, and you know, some people like to have that. Occasionally, we end up with a second dishwasher.
Yeah.
You know, these are all things that are often part of a kitchen renovation.
I think some of the main features of sinks themselves, workstation style sinks, have really been popular lately. At Bella Domicile, we carry the Galley brand, which is a pretty extensive collection of options available. But there are almost any manufacturer of sinks now have a workstation style. And what that means is that there's a rail that runs along the front and back edges of the sink where cutting boards, colanders, drain boards, they can basically kind of lock in on top of the sink. That can just make it more convenient. You're not walking back and forth quite as much between a countertop and the sink, and so you're working more efficiently within that sink space, and or kind of locking things in. Maybe they're not slipping or you know, falling on the floor, and so I guess there's a little aspect of safety that comes into it as well. And they're kind of cool and fun. kind of a new feature. A lot of sinks now have what's called a low divide. And so if you still want to have two drains, two bowls to the main sink, instead of having that middle piece coming way up and getting in the way when you've got a big pot or pan that you're trying to wash or fill up, that middle piece is down lower. And so it gives you a lot more maneuverability of your pots and pans to function in that sink space.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Phil and Stevens Point, let's go to you now. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a walkout basement, and I'm wondering the possibilities for either having a laundry room and bathroom combination or keeping them separate. What the guests think would be the pros and cons of each.
Yeah. Dana, what do you think?
I've done quite a few spaces. I've got one right now that we have a combination of the laundry and bathroom. I think the benefit would be to conserve space. And so I've had some areas where we really don't have a lot of room. And so only having one sink that serves the laundry area and the bathroom area can be very helpful. You've got to think a little bit about your use of the area. And so if you need to be changing loads of laundry, but somebody's likely to be in there using the facilities, that may provide more of a frustrating situation that you may not like in the end. Or if this is a guest space, maybe you don't want them seeing your baskets of laundry sitting out, and that becomes more of a task for you to now clean out the laundry room before your guests arrive. And that may add more stress than you want to deal with. So there's a lot to consider with it.
Yeah, Phil, what do you? Does that help?
Well, that's helpful. I'm debating which way to go, but I never even thought about guests and needing the bathroom while you got to do laundry or cleaning it up. So yeah, that was helpful. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I have my I don't really have a laundry room, but I've got in my bathroom upstairs next to the bedroom, I have my washer and dryer. They're stacked in the bathroom, and I find it very convenient. The laundry kind of stays in the, you know, until I'm ready to wash.
Yeah.
Sure.
Stays in the bedroom, and then I just, you know, 4-5 steps, I'm into the kitchen or into the bathroom.
Sure.
It can be great. A lot of times we do consider, though, where do you have the basket management? Where do you have the detergents?
Right.
And sometimes it is great to tuck a washer and dryer somewhere more convenient, but you've also got the paraphernalia that comes with it. And so making sure that you're not creating trip hazards.
Right.
And, or again, more just management before people come over. There are a few other things to think about other than just simply where the washer and dryer go.
And I would add on the plus side that when we've done this kind of the dual laundry bathroom for a few of our clients, a feature that we often include is putting some sort of a drying rack in the shower, because the shower is a great place to hang up shirts or other clothes that you're wanting to air dry. Because in a bathroom, of course, you've got a good ventilation fan, or certainly if we've renovated it and put in a high-quality fan, and it can drip right there into the shower. And so there are very practical ways to leverage combining those spaces, but you do have to have all the consideration about cleaning it up so it can be a functional bathroom.
Yeah, that's good. All good points. Speaking of ceiling fans, you mentioned Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to ask, are strong bathroom ceiling fans more apt to pull in towel lint that sticks in damp ducts? Unless motors are moved, bathroom fan ducts are hard to reach with a vacuum cleaner wand.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the grill of a bathroom fan is going to, you know, you're going to have to clean that occasionally. And typically what we would recommend for that is to just take a brush attachment on a vacuum cleaner and just, you know, gently, you know, kind of swipe the the grill when the fan isn't running. Clean it up. It is true that, you know, between the electrostatic issues on the fan and the fact that air is moving, being sucked into that, inevitably some things will collect on that grill.
Makes good sense. Questions for our guest today? I hope you'll join in as we talk home renovation with our guest Dana Langreck of Bella Domicile of Madison and Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today on WPR News, taking a look at home renovation today with Dana Langreck of Bella Domicile and Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. Great to have both of them with us. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Cheryl in Green Bay. Cheryl, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a question about expanding some living space in a home that's about 60 years old, and it has a block basement. And I'm wondering if it's problematic to, you know, cut the block so that you can install an egress window.
Yeah, so thanks for the question, Cheryl. I mean, any foundation wall can be altered to accommodate an egress window or new windows, but it does certainly require a mason and or someone who's with a center block. You're typically going to have a mason involved in that, and there may be some structural considerations, you know, based on the current condition of those block walls. So it's going to have to be looked at carefully to determine, you know, what the loads are and if there's any settling or distortion. Sometimes we have to do some things to strap the center block together and to add some additional load-bearing features around that new window. But these are all things that are commonly done, and you just want to make sure that those things are considered during the planning for the project.
And it's a 60-year-old, roughly, home, so 60-year-old. So
So that means the house was built in the mid-60s, and I'll say that, you know, just as a general rule, like, that's the high watermark of construction in the United States. I mean, homes built really from the mid-50s into the mid-60s, I mean, that's when, you know, production building, we had, you know, high standards and certainly, you know, a lot of quality materials and quality techniques and a pretty substantial skilled labor force to do those things. And so when we renovate homes, like, it's always a pleasure to be working on homes from that period. And it's not that, you know, homes from other periods just have different challenges. And cinder block foundations, I find to be the most challenging of, you know, where, of course, it's in some respects, it's easier to open it up. because you're just removing the blocks and, you know, putting in a lintel and doing some other things. Whereas with a concrete poured foundation, you're going to have to cut through that concrete.
Yeah.
Like I say, each type of system in a building has its own challenges and opportunities. So sure. It certainly can be done.
Cheryl, you are you happy with your answer?
I am. Thank you. I hadn't focused on the fact that you might need to have a mason involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't recommend just chipping out some blocks. you know, it is definitely going to, you know, there are some things that need to be done done well. So,
yeah.
But I think you'll find that it it'll be a great improvement. You know, to bring some natural light and the potential for a safe egress out of the space. We do a lot of egress windows for folks in the Madison area. So
yeah.
Good luck with your project.
Thank you, Cheryl. Let's go to Paul in Wausau. Paul, hi.
Hello. You know, I'm a retired guy. I'm looking for information. I was in the construction business many years ago, but I'm looking to build a small, like a 900-square-foot retirement home. And I guess I'm looking for more information about the exterior wall detail. It seems like it's changing all the time. You know, I built a house years ago in Wausau with the old Rodney Wright, you know, super insulated. And it's, you know, it's from then till now, a lot of the vapor, you know, ideas have changed. So I'm looking for what you do for an exterior wall detail.
Okay. Well, I mean, there are a variety of resources out there that can help, you know, present the kind of the best science and the best practices for now. And so some of the places that I like to go to research some of these options would be the Green Home Advisor, which you can find online.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also Joe Lisebrick's website, buildingscience.com, which is an excellent source. I mean, if you go there, you know, you will see schematics of different wall construction details and what is recommended in different climate zones. And Passive House USA is also another great place to go for high efficiency building techniques and systems. You know, there are a lot of different materials and approaches. I mean, you know, what you do at some point in the wall, in part, will depend on what's going to be on the exterior. So, you know, there's not just like one answer to the question, but there are some great resources out there that I hope will, you know, kind of give you the current thinking on that.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
Yeah, that is. I guess that's kind of what I was looking for. I'm also, you know, I've watched different videos, and with a really tight, you know, super insulated house with the ventilation for a bathroom and kitchen, I really haven't seen anything how they recommend to do that. I mean, if your house is so tight, where are you going to suck that air from to exhaust the bathroom fan?
Sure. So, and that's a great question. And so the simple answer to that is that you're going to have an ERV or an HRV unit, which is going to be a whole house ventilating unit. It's going to bring in fresh air and exhaust the stale air. And often those systems would be installed that would be integrated with the bathroom fans. It would also integrate from a pressure perspective with the hood vent, so that you're always going to achieve some balance with the air. In a tight home, you've got to mechanically bring in fresh air when you're exhausting air, because there is no substantial leakage, and so you can end up with some indoor air quality problems if you don't design that into it. But there again, there are some standard systems out there, and they've come a long way. And while there, I would say, you know, there's certainly you have to find a heating and ventilation contractor that is mm-hmm. comfortable working with these systems and providing excellent systems within a high efficiency tight home, because not all contractors really specialize in that.
Yeah.
But if you find the right people and the right systems, you can have a very healthy home, and all of that can work well.
Yeah.
So good luck with that.
Good luck with that. Dana, you know, I was thinking as Paul was talking about, it's a 900-square-foot house, and so then you figure out the kitchen area of that is going to be relatively small. I mean, are there ways to, or how do you advise, or maybe you don't get this very often, but how do you advise making a smaller space as user-friendly and as possible?
Sure. I think strategically, you've got to think about it in a little different way than a typical space.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things that helps out are thinking about appliances a little differently.
Yeah.
So instead of maybe a traditional 30-inch wide range, maybe it's just a two-burner cooktop. And then that gives you the flexibility to get more countertop space, and then building in your oven into the cabinetry. Most people, typical kitchens have a 36-inch refrigerator, but maybe it's just a refrigerator drawer unit. So you can get drawer refrigerators that are only 24 inches wide, or there are some different sizes. Or maybe it's utilizing a freezer in an adjacent room or somewhere if you're not frequently accessing that freezer space. And so thinking about the appliances in a small space can definitely help out. There's a lot of combination type units, so like microwave and oven capacity together. So instead of needing two appliances, now you only need one. There are even countertop style appliances that maybe could be considered now, just depending on, is this a daily use space? Is this just a weekend space? So I think that's one thing to really think about, is the flexibility of appliances.
And those sinks you were talking about earlier would be a really great part of a small home, because those are so space efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. Because then you can use your cutting board right on the sink instead of needing a lot more countertop space next to the sink.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I assume there are, I actually watched a video not long ago about the inside of a camper type, and looking at all of the rollout things that you can, you know, that come out of the wall and so forth. I imagine there's plenty of that too.
There are a lot of gadgets and fun things that help you utilize some small spaces and still get a lot of storage in those areas, for sure.
Paul, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Jim in Wyawega, you had a question for us?
Hi, Larry. We're going to be building a new home. It's going to be our retirement home. We're downsizing. We're planning on going with a slab on grade, about a 2,200 square foot house. The considerations we had were putting the laundry room near the bedrooms, because that's where most of the dirty laundry is generated. And then also we are looking at doing a scullery adjacent to the kitchen to keep the mess, and kind of a combination butler pantry. And then lastly, I wanted to know their opinion about prefab built homes versus on-site or stick-built homes.
Lots of good questions there, and fortunately, we'll have a minute or two to think about this, because we need to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here. But Jim, you can either hang on or for follow-ups, or I think our guests probably have pretty much figured out what your questions are all about. We will be back with Dana Langreck of Bella Domicile and Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build of Madison and Monona, our guests. And they'll be back right after the news. You stay with us.
Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, remodeling is can be one of the most significant ways to increase the value of your home. Projects like the kitchen or the bathroom can be a little expensive, and we're getting some guidance today from Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build in Madison. Also with us, Dana Langreich, who is a lead sales designer at Bella Domicile. It's a Madison-based home design renovation firms. Great to have both of them with us today. And you can join in. Questions, give a call. The number 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And we had a call from Jim, I believe, who had a question, a few questions.
Yeah.
He was building, going to have a new home on a slab.
Yep, about a 2,200 square foot home. And one of the questions that he asked about was whether prefab might be a good way to go. And, I mean, full disclosure, Jim, I am not a new home builder, so we don't. We've never, even with an addition, gone the prefab path. But I will say, because of my interest in all these things, that the future of home building, no doubt, is in prefab construction. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens in this scenario is that the walls it's typically the walls, or and sometimes maybe the if there's an intermediate floor that might be prefabricated and brought in, craned into position, tilted up, and connected together. A lot of the mechanical systems have already been roughed in to those walls, or there are there are pathways that are designed into them for that stuff to be run. And so it's a very efficient way to go because you can build all the parts, the big parts, in a factory where you have both the tools and a working environment.
Rain.
Yeah, you know, you're not worried about the weather. You can achieve levels of perfection or excellence that harder to achieve when you're stick building something out in the field and you're in the mud and you're dealing with the weather. And, you know, oftentimes just the staging for placing a wall on the edge of a structure is just more complicated when you're out on the job site. But the big parts can be brought together, and I'm a big fan of This Old House on public television, and they've had some great programs that kind of show us all the magic of both how these parts are constructed in the factory and then how they're put together in the field. And so it's a great way to go. I mean, I think you get more bang for the buck and you end up with a better product. But, of course, you're going to need a builder that is used to doing it that way. So
some good advantages. I was thinking back to my college days when I spent the summer working building on products like that with a builder here from the Madison area, and we got the materials came from Seney, Michigan. I remember that very, very well. Well, his other questions had to do with a scullery. He was interested in a scullery, so that is kind of next to the kitchen, or maybe kind of part of the kitchen in a way, Dana.
It's an area where you can maybe contain your mess, I guess, is a lot of times what the main purpose might be. Or some people, if they do a lot of catering with events, it's a great staging area for other people coming into the home that might have more containers that they're bringing with them. Or, again, just an area where the guests are not necessarily seeing the behind-the-scenes messy part of food preparation or cleanup.
I've seen them where, too, where all your canned products and all that wind up out there.
Yeah, you've got to think a little bit about your daily use space and the reason for doing it. Is it just because you don't want to see the mess? But you also have to consider how do you get the dishes back and forth? If you're storing a lot of your food and dishes in the main part of the exposed kitchen, then you're walking back and forth between this other area, or maybe you've got wet floor from dripping at the sink. You do want to consider the safety and the convenience factor when you're considering that.
Well, there was also a question I thought relating to laundry near the bedroom.
Yeah. Laundry near the bedroom is fantastic as far as convenience, especially near the primary bedroom where most of the clothes are generated long term. And it sounds like this is a retirement home, so that is primarily where the clothes will be generated. So easy convenience for putting the dirty clothes into the washer and dryer and then bringing the clean clothes back out into the closet or dressers. I would only maybe think of considering the sound. So like when you run the washer and dryer, you may need to take some consideration of where you locate the washer and dryer compared to the bed, if there's going to be sound generated when somebody is sleeping. And then also maybe sight lines of if you are maybe on a chair reading in the bedroom or in the bed, what do you see if that laundry room door is open?
Yeah. And I hope that helps out. Was that Jim in Denmark? Jim, are you there?
Wauwega or something?
Oh, I think Jim was in Wauwega. We have another Jim. Okay. Jim in Denmark. Let's go there. Jim, hi.
Hi, Larry. I'm getting my Jims mixed up. Larry, and guests, I have, I'm a retired engineer on crutches. So I have a couple of bathroom ideas for remodeling. And a question for the guests.
Okay.
A no-slip floor is like my idea number one for a bathroom. And we have rough tile, clay tile in our bathroom. And it works really good to prevent slipping. Mm-hmm. So that's one. And then two is as you get old, everyone needs a tub. Not just a shower stall. Because a shower stall, if you have a lame leg, you hit it on the sharp lips that contain the glass, sliding glass. I really recommend a tub with a wide wall so you can get your butt up on it. Hmm. And that's two. And then three is you should have a sink near the toilet. So that you have at least one surface to push yourself off the toilet with. And I find that really helpful in our bathroom.
Yeah.
I think you've brought up some really good points there. I may challenge you a little bit on one of the items about the tub. There are ways to make showers very safe. And so sometimes a tub can actually be more dangerous than a shower space. But every home is a little bit different. Everybody's needs are a little different. And so in your scenario, yes, maybe the tub is the best route to go, as long as you've got, like you mentioned, a wide ledge that you can put your bottom on and swing your legs in. But you'd want to have maybe a safety bar close by that you can grab a hold of as you're doing that movement in. I think that is something to consider for any showering or bathing facility. It's the movement in and out of the shower or the tub, especially when you're wet, and making sure that there are safety bars in the right locations for those transfer points.
Yeah, and I would just add, Dana, that I would agree. That. The points that Jim is making about the needs are spot on in many respects. Like you have to have safety first and foremost in mind. Now it's possible that putting a sink next to the toilet is going to make it easier to get up off the toilet. But what we've often done beyond that is there, as you suggested, good grab bars or safety bars that are installed. We find in many of our projects that there are some very attractive towel bars that are designed to do double duty as grab bars. And so they're primarily there to hang your towels on. But if you need to grab a hold of them to steady yourself,
you're
or
not going to pull them out, though.
That's right. They're going to be sturdy and have a high rating for resistance, and that's a great way to go. And it's not aesthetically challenging. It doesn't look institutional. It actually looks beautiful, and it's very functional.
I've got a couple projects right now that it's a combination toilet paper holder and grab bar.
Yeah.
So everybody needs to have the toilet paper holder, and now you get the safety aspect combined in one.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Jim, thank you very much for calling. And here we have Barbara from Fort Walton Beach, Florida, with us. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. We built our final home, our resting place, thinking ahead to retirement and all. Few years ago, and there's two things that you haven't mentioned and I would like to bring up. First of all, a solid surface flooring, whatever wood or whatever, versus carpet, because at some point we may need wheelchairs, walkers, or something that needs that. And secondly, we made as many doors as possible, at least 3 feet wide, considering the same mode of transportation, so to speak. And maybe if we had to call 911 or somebody, we wanted wider doors all through the house.
Yeah, those are great points, Barbara. And in fact, I actually had a note to mention that with the last caller and just didn't get to it. But absolutely, a 36-inch door, whenever you can accommodate it, like for the for one of the gyms who called about the retirement home, that's absolutely recommended for all those reasons that you just stated. For whatever your mobility needs are, having a wide access is safer. And solid surface flooring has other benefits over carpet. Carpet holds a lot of lint and dust and things that can diminish air quality in a home. And having solid wood or tile or other surfaces, as long as they're safe, slip-resistant surfaces, that is often a healthier home. And you can, of course, have area rugs if you're so inclined, but those are trip hazards. So anyway, those are great points.
I was just going to say I would consider heated floors as part of it, just as a luxury item, but as a safety item. And
right.
And so just you mentioned the rugs on the floor, that can become something that could be a problem with a walker or cane.
Yep.
And so not only considering the heat just as a luxury, but really to keep you safe so you don't have to use those rugs and still
sure.
feel very comfortable in there.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Barbara, thank you so much for contributing that all the way from Florida. Appreciate it very much. And just on small homes again, Penny emailed a comment on the 900-square-foot home. She has a 1,000-square-foot home, and the ground floor of which was the main living space. A galley kitchen included a full-size range, a dishwasher, a 36-inch fridge. The house has a large bathroom, a huge bedroom, and two very large closets and a large open kitchen dining room, also a separate laundry. So she doesn't consider a 900-square-foot home small by any means.
That's
especially
great.
Yeah. Especially if it's a retirement home.
Sure. I mean, sometimes there's the trade-off. Maybe she has less bedrooms in the house
mm-hmm.
was able to get more space into her kitchen, and every home could be a little different.
Yeah. I downsized to a 1,050-square-foot condo back about 8 years ago, and we decided it was a little smaller than we wanted, and we have upgraded a bit. But, I mean, had that unit been laid out a little bit better, it might have functioned as our forever home.
And Joe in Chippewa Falls emailed, and this goes back to the prefabs or the modular homes. He's heard it can be difficult to get insurance for it and wonders if that's true. I have not heard that was an issue, maybe years back.
Yeah, I'm not. I cannot imagine what the case would be. Now, I realize, say, like what we think of as like a mobile home, That's a different thing. And so I'm not sure what that would be, but from my perspective and everything I know about just the building quality, if a home that has been built off site in a modular way, that thing which I'm familiar with that is often done today, I would think would be both the most cost effective to build and to insure. But
maybe
there's something we don't know.
David in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I really enjoy your shows, so thank you much.
Thank you.
And your guests as well. So they just had a question. I've got a Vermont slate bathroom floor and in the entry also, and I'm going to keep that, but I'm going to do a new countertop in the bathroom, and the counter is put two separate sinks in, but I'm thinking about having what would technically be a kitchen-style single, like a farmhouse sink, in there, and maybe out of hammered copper. But what would you suggest to put on there for material for that countertop, like soapstone, or I don't want to go with slate, that's not going to work there, you know?
Yeah. Dana?
Well, I'd say the world of quartz has opened up dramatically over the last few years, and so there are so many different colors and patterns available with quartz countertops that a lot of times it's a matter of bringing some samples in and looking at it next to your floor to make sure that you've got some colors that are coordinating, and you don't want anything necessarily taking away from the beauty of that slate. I'm guessing you like that, mm-hmm. and that's why you want to keep it there. And so to me, the first goal would be to make sure we're still enhancing the look of that and not taking away from the beauty of it.
Yeah. So in your, I mean, like your business, you'd take samples or have him take samples home and look at them? And
absolutely. They can look very different from a showroom into the home. Lighting changes. So sometimes colors can look a little differently there. There are a lot of great natural stones that you can consider as well. I guess my first thought is either a quartz or a granite versus getting into just a laminate or a Corian solid surface, just because of the beauty of the natural stone and enhancing that with a stone countertop.
Yeah.
A good pairing.
Yeah. All right. Some options there, David. Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Mary in Lodi. Mary, hi.
Hi there. I'm a retired social worker. I worked with adults with physical disabilities and living in their own homes. And one of the things that I would suggest for people, rather than kind of try this or try that, to consult with an occupational therapist. They can look at a person's accessibility needs with unbelievably open expertise and make suggestions in the bathroom, in the kitchen, the hallway, places where their accessibility needs are very high, and can recommend products that will be, you know, functional for those individuals. And I've seen firsthand how incredibly wonderful it makes people stay in their homes longer and safer.
I
that would be one of my suggestions, rather than kind of guessing or thinking, you know, well, my friend has this and I think maybe I'll try it. This is coming from an expert looking at that individual person's need.
That's a great point, Mary. Thanks for the call. From our perspective in the design and renovation world, we're, of course, guided by the particular needs of our clients, but then we also come from a perspective of universal design, which is a movement that is just focused on making sure that houses are built in a more thoughtful, safe manner for people of all abilities. And so you are both correct that we always want to gear the solutions to the particular needs of the occupants, while also thinking more globally about, you know, all future occupants. And even those of us that might be younger and completely physically able will benefit from a safer design so that when something happens, the house can accommodate us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I just remembered my daycare provider had even come to me with she sometimes deals with has kids with special needs in her care. And we created a special countertop that overhung past the cabinet a little further, and we had cutouts in there so that the kids could actually grab a hold of the front of the countertop to be able to get themselves close enough to the sink to be able to wash their hands on their own. So it's great to consider safety and accommodating all ages, not right. even just those 50 plus.
Sure. <Yeah. laughs>
Even though some of us in this room are, at least one of us is well past 50. Let's put it that way. Well, here in the last minute or so, any advice, Dana? What have you got for any last minute tip or relating to design?
I do have to say that working with a professional, even if you've got some great ideas or photos, hiring someone to come in and make it all work together really can pay off in the end. And so even if you had like 10 really great ideas, but those 10 things together would look absolutely terrible or not function well, it's not going to be money worth spent. And so coming in, hiring somebody that can help you sort through those things and really focus on the best aspects to really make you happy in the end, I think is money totally worth spent.
Yeah. Yeah. Chad? Yeah.
A thoughtful design, good planning. I mean, that's the best investment you'll ever make when you are contemplating improvements to your home, so that, you've considered the options and you've decided which solutions are right for you. So that you don't have regrets when it's all done.
Yeah, makes really good sense. Dan, you guys make good sense all the time. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really a pleasure.
Oh,
I hope
you,
we can do
thank
it again.
You. Yeah, you bet.
Thank you.
Dana Langreck is a lead sales designer at Bella Domicile. It's a Madison-based home design renovation firm. She's been designing kitchens and baths for 23 years. And, of course, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build of Madison, and by way of further explanation, one of WPR's many business sponsors, and we appreciate that as well. Great to have both of them with us today. And another part of the home is how you power it, and more homes in this country have been powered by wind energy. And that's coming up next as we talk about the pros and maybe some of the cons of wind as a renewable energy source. Michael Vickerman comes back. Well, it'll be great to see him again. I haven't seen him for a little while. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We've talked a lot on this show in recent years and months about solar panels and solar farms, but we've spent much less time talking about another renewable energy source, and that's wind power. And thought it was worth the time to take a closer look at that. There's some things going on with wind power in the state, some proposals, and there's, I think, 9 at least wind power operation. Well, I'll find out. Let's talk to Mike Vickerman. Michael Vickerman is former executive director of Renew Wisconsin. He retired in 2024 after 33 years with that renewable energy advocacy organization. And it's great to have him back. He and I haven't talked on this show for probably since 2023, maybe, Michael? I don't remember exactly.
Mike. Oh, well before then.
Yeah, it's been a while, for sure. But as you listen to Michael, I hope you'll join in. Have you seen large collections of wind turbines in our state and wonder why or how much energy or electricity they produce? you know, how wind power compares to solar power generation. We can cover that and a whole lot more with Michael, and I hope you'll join in. Questions, give a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Michael, welcome, of course. Wind energy, it accounts for, what, about 3% of the electricity we produce here in the state?
Yeah, it's about 3%. Now, a little caveat on that. Actually, much more wind actually flows through the utility lines to customers, but much of that wind power is acquired from out of state.
Maybe Iowa. Do we get it from
In Iowa, almost 6 out of every 10 kilowatt hours produced there is from a wind turbine.
It's amazing to me, like 60% of their energy needs in the state of Iowa are covered by wind.
Yeah, it's an astonishing figure. But some of those wind turbines are owned by Wisconsin utilities, such as Madison Gas and Electric has a pretty large plant just east of Interstate, I think it's 35. And that is the largest source of renewable power that is supplied to its customers. And that's just one example. Mm-hmm. There are a half dozen others.
So, and I know there's a new wind farm proposed for Columbia County. I'm sure you're aware of that. You know about that project?
I do. It's in a very early stage of being reviewed by the Public Service Commission. But it's there are a lot of interesting observations one can draw from it. Because right now, Columbia County has the largest wind project operating in the state of Wisconsin. It's called Glacier Hills, and it's in the Randolph area of Columbia County. That has 90 turbines. This project that's proposed by Alliant Energy will have only half the number of turbines, 47, but almost 60% more rated capacity. And that tells you that there's been a dramatic change in the degree of productivity between the turbines that were installed in 2011, 15 years ago, and today.
So they're much more efficient? Is that it? Or
they're much more powerful. And the reason why they've amped up the power production is because the engineers have learned how to extend the length of the blades, which increases the power conversion zone. And they've done it in such a way that so two things happen. One is there's just much more air flowing along by the blades. The second thing is the longer blades access very strong winds at the top of the arc.
Yeah.
There's a pretty substantial differential in the strength of the wind between the top of the blade orbit, if you will, or the circulation, and the bottom. And so these new turbines are actually much more amenable, or much more conducive to Wisconsin's wind resource, which is not exactly a rip-roaring resource. But with the slightly taller towers and with especially the longer blades, they have made a substantial increase in productivity.
So here, you look at the other states like Iowa, Minnesota maybe, producing quite a bit of their energy from wind. Why haven't we done more in that area? I mean, what's the difference between Iowa and Wisconsin?
I would single out two factors. The first is that Iowa has a lower population density. It is more resolutely agricultural, and it's the agricultural nature is not just simply more meaning more farms, but also a culture that comes with it, where there's it is more accepted there to work the land, and the neighbors respect the landowner's decisions to host a wind turbine. That's part of it. The other is that the winds blow a little bit better, or with more strength in Iowa than compared with Wisconsin. And a combination of that made Iowa a particularly attractive place to build many wind projects. Almost all of them are utility owned. But yeah, so Iowa is really the poster child of wind power development. The technology had to catch up a little bit in order to generate electricity in Wisconsin in a cost-effective fashion. So what was available in 2010 or 2015 was not the best fit for Wisconsin, but with the new generation of turbines, it has become a very economical option.
And I drive through Iowa from time to time on my way to Kansas to visit my daughter, and it feels like the expanse of farmland across the whole state is larger and making it more open, let's put it that way, and making it more desirable. I mean, you can't put those wind units right next to each other. I mean, they need space.
Correct. And so in Wisconsin, what you're seeing is with this slow rebirth of wind power development, the center of development is in southwest Wisconsin, which has a much lower population density than eastern Wisconsin. There's a project in Grant County that's been operating for about 3 years now called Red Barn. And Columbia is scheduled to, I mean, if it's approved, it would start operating in 3 years. But alongside an existing project that's been operating for 15 years without any sort of hiccup or complaint or any grumbling, it's been a very it's been an accepted part of the landscape now.
You know, I watched a little news video. I think it was CBS did one on wind energy and farms, and looking at it from the farmer's point of view, one of the real advantages to me, it seems, is that a farmer will be compensated quite a bit for this, while at the same time not losing a lot of their land.
Yes, that is the value proposition for the property owner. You've pretty much nailed it. One important detail is that the revenue stream from hosting wind turbines is constant. It is predictable. It is, almost the exact opposite of what a typical farmer usually experiences with fluctuating commodity prices and expenses. So that helps the farmer hold on to that property and makes it more attractive perhaps to that farmer's sons and daughters to take over the operation.
In that particular video, I mean, and I don't even know how many windmills were operating on her property or anything else, but she was getting about $35,000 a year from it, and her husband had passed away, and she was in danger of losing the farm, and the only thing that's really saved her and made the farm continue to be productive in the community was that $35,000 a year.
It's a very underappreciated aspect of wind power, is that it reinforces the farmer's resolve to continue farming.
Yeah. Michael Vickerman, our guest today, the former executive director of Renew Wisconsin, no longer on the staff, but remains a board member of Renew Wisconsin, our guest today. It's great to have him back.
And if you have a question or comment relating to wind power, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. My dad built our home back in on a farm back in 1958. The home went up. And today, so I think about 3 years ago, the farm across the road from us, the guy passed on, and the family now has across from us a solar farm. So a solar farm is, and when you're comparing the two, Michael, I don't know if you do this or not, but comparing solar versus wind. Is it not as easy, easier, better, or are they both just good things?
I mean, from the standpoint of the landowner, from the utility?
Well, from both.
Okay. So solar has made much more of an inroad in Wisconsin than wind power has for a variety of reasons. In Wisconsin, the wind resources concentrated in a few locations. And for example, along the Niagara Escarpment in eastern Wisconsin and along the Military Ridge in southwestern Wisconsin, where there's high ground and open land, wind becomes actually a viable option. And of course, you have to have transmission lines nearby. But the resource is much more evenly distributed in, yeah. If it's solar. There's a little bit of difference between the amount of sunshine available in Oconee County versus Grant County, but it's much more evenly distributed. So if you look at where the solar projects are, and we have now several dozen operating projects of ranging from a couple of megawatts to 300 megawatts. The 300-megawatt solar farm is on the edge of Iowa and Grant County. It's called Badger Hollow. And there's a wind project now under construction right next door to Badger Hollow. And but you'll notice they run from Grant County to Kenosha County and all the way up to past I-94 going into Hudson and later the Twin Cities. And there are projects in the northeastern quadrant of the state. It's basically the what motivates the selection of a particular location for solar is proximity to a strong transmission, a strong part of the transmission grid. So, but the interesting thing about solar is that it is scalable up, is easily scalable upward and easily scalable downward. So you can scale a solar array down to something that fits on your rooftop, and it still makes economic sense. Now, for the very large solar projects, they're competing in the wholesale market, where electricity prices generally range about 4 to 5 to 6 cents. And for homeowners, they're looking to offset electricity price at 18, 19 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's a very different price that to beat. So that is another factor in solar's favor. And the last thing about solar I have to point out is that it's a very easy to maintain a technology. You set the panels out, and they just sit there and bask underneath the sun. And and they don't experience much wear and tear. The degradation over the course of years and decades is pretty minute. It works in the long term.
Michael Vickerman, our guest today, as we talk with him about wind, and we've gotten into solar as well. Our guest today, it's great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today. Larry Mueller here with Michael Vickerman, a member of the board of directors of Renew Wisconsin. He was the executive director, retired in 2024 from that after 33 years with the Renewable Energy Advocacy Association. And callers with questions, Mike in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I live in a very windy area, Madison, and I've been for a decade thinking about putting wind turbines on the ridge of my roof, even though I've been told I'm not allowed to. Even though they're small, 1 meter or 4 foot diameter ones, and they're like sailboat size. And so that leads me to my question, which is the rules for installing wind turbines in residential urban areas. And second question is your opinion on the vertical wind turbines for residential use and why we haven't started using any of those for large scale commercial uses.
Okay.
All right. So in regards to what you can do on your property in within a municipality, it's all set forth within the municipal zoning code. So you probably would need to situate the turbine at least the length of the vertical length of the turbine. That includes the uppermost extension of the blades. You have to set that back by at least one times the tower in total height. You mentioned attaching a turbine to your rooftop. I would not recommend that. I would advise strongly against that. The last thing you want to do is to attach your house to a device that's going to vibrate, and it's going to vibrate significantly in high wind events. Your house is not built to absorb that kind of stress, that kind of torque that's placed on one part of the rooftop. If you want to explore the small turbine option, please consider just planting it in the ground and working from there. You'll be happier with the results. Last question was about vertical axis wind turbines. So to describe that to your listeners, these are turbines that basically look like egg beaters. They bow out and reach their maximum circumference at the center of the tower, and then they slope back towards the top of the tower. It's possible that there will come a particular manufacturing process that makes vertical axis wind turbines an economically rational way to generate electricity for yourself. There is a built-in problem with vertical axis wind turbines, and that is that the resource, the strength of the wind, increases with height, but the maximum power conversion area for a vertical wind turbine is exactly one half of the tower height. So you're kind of, there's a reason why wind turbines look like pinwheels. It's to capture the strong winds. Your vertical axis wind turbine is operating with a substantially inferior wind resource.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Dave in Oconto County, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Yes, that was a very interesting comment about the vertical. I believe they're also known as the tulip turbine. And on financial,
oh nuts! You're breaking up. Oh man, I'm really sorry for that, Dave. We just can't hear you. He was talking about financial benefits in Iowa. I had a question, I think, relating to that. And I think the financial benefits for Iowa residents is pretty good.
I'm not aware, actually, of any incentive programs for residential wind turbines in Iowa. They may be offered by the utility as opposed to the state.
I was thinking about the cost in terms of rates.
Iowa's electric rates are significantly lower than Wisconsin's electric rates. So that's a good thing if you're just a ordinary customer. But if you're trying to offset the cost of energy by supplying it yourself, that actually complicates matters, and you probably have to wait much longer before the investment amortizes and you start earning a positive return.
Scott in Sun Prairie, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry and Mike. See, I've got kind of a weird economic question. I'm a great fan of the Apple TV series Landman, where Billy Bob Thornton plays the guy who negotiates oil leases in the southwest of Texas, sort of the antithesis of what we're talking about here. But in one episode, he has his son, and they're looking at a big wind turbine. He goes on this long rant about how wind turbines are not economical, that by the time you produce all the parts and put them up and do all the maintenance on them, there's no better for the environment than oil would be. I'm assuming that was $75 a barrel oil. But is there any truth to that? Should I believe Billy Bob?
It goes without saying that you're relying on a work of fiction there. But as it relates to wind power development, the state with the largest investment in wind generation is Texas. Texas has about 30% of its electricity comes from wind power. The state is almost ideal for wind generation because of the large expanses of open land. The one limiting factor in Texas is access to transmission. But Texas, wind development in Texas has been 100% success story in that state. Now, electricity does different things than a barrel of oil. A barrel of oil's principal value comes in the form of providing motion and power, especially in vehicles, fairly inexpensively. Electricity really can't do that. Electricity's the uses of electricity, and basically 20% of the energy we use in this country comes out as electricity. 80% is fuel of one sort or another. Electricity is great at driving motors. Electricity is outstanding for lighting interiors, powering radio stations. It does a lot of little things very, very well. And you wouldn't want to have a internal combustion engine doing the same thing. So the comparison that's drawn up, and which Billy Bob Thornton opines on, is really kind of apples and oranges. They're both extremely useful technologies, and they occupy very different places in the national and global economy.
They do indeed, although Landman is a pretty good, fun show to watch. Mm-hmm.
I should watch that, yeah.
It's really kind of an interesting look at the oil industry itself, which I found really... So should state and utility companies invest more in renewable?
The utilities are, in fact, on their own, investing almost, a very large percentage of their generation-based investments is going into renewables, going into solar and wind and battery storage. That's also a part of it. The relationship between renewables and battery storage to the emerging digital economy is something that a recent announcement in Minnesota sheds light on in rather dramatic fashion. Google signed a contract with Xcel Energy, which is the largest electric utility in Minnesota, also supplies a good portion of western Wisconsin. In this, as a part of this contract, Google will pay for all of the capital expenditure required to provide a lot of wind, a little bit of solar, and a lot of battery storage capacity. And why is it doing this? It's because it's the least expensive way to supply whatever facilities or data centers and other ancillary activities there.
That they're going to need.
Yeah.
And we're out of time. Michael, come back and be with us again. I appreciate it very much.
Love to be here.
Michael Vickerman, former executive director of Renew Wisconsin. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store.